And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, today's October 21st, 294th day of the year. Leap year is 295th. 71 days until the end of this year. And everybody's going to be happy when it's over. Now, October 21st is a very interesting date in history. In the year 1096, a Seljuk Turkish army successfully fight off the People's Crusade. Now, not a lot of folks are familiar with that. Everybody knows about the Crusades, when armies authorized by the Pope descended on the Middle East to reclaim the Holy Land. But there was a... Many people call it the prelude to the Crusades. It was called the People's Crusade. It was the first, the largest, most well-documented of the popular Crusades. It lasted roughly 6 months, from April to October in 1096. And it's been called either a prelude to the First Crusade or a distinct part of the First Crusade. It wasn't one of the Prince's Crusades, which was much more well-organized, well-armed, and well-funded. It's also been called the Peasants' Crusade, the Pauper's Crusade, or the Popular Crusade. It wasn't part of the official Catholic Church-organized expeditions. It was led by a man by the name of Peter the Hermit, with forces of Walter Sansevoire. It was basically an untrained peasant army, and it was going to take back Jerusalem. Well, it was literally destroyed by the forces of the Seljuk Sultanate of Rum under Khalij Arslan at the Battle of Sivatol in northwestern Anatolia, which is in Turkey. Historically, there's been much debate over whether Peter was actually the real initiator of the Crusade. There are many who believe Pope Urban II did it quietly behind the scenes, so to speak. The expedition's independence also been used by some historians, such as Heinrich Hagenmeier, to prove that, in fact, Peter was the real initiator. Now, Pope Urban II planned the departure of the First Crusade for August 15th, 1096. But a number of unexpected bands of peasants and low-ranking knights organized themselves and set off for Jerusalem on their own. The peasant population had been afflicted by drought and famine and disease for many, many years before 1096, and a lot of them seemed to think this was an escape from these hardships. And then there'd been some meteorological occurrences beginning in 1095 that seemed to be a divine blessing for the movement. And also, you had the millennianism, as it was called, the belief the end of the world was imminent. So the response to that was beyond expectations. I mean, Urban might have expected a few thousand knights, ended up with a migration numbering close to 100,000, mostly unskilled fighters, including women and children. Now, Peter the Hermit was a charismatic monk and a powerful speaker. And he was a spiritual leader of the movement. He was known for riding a donkey and dressing in simple clothing. And he'd gone through northern France and Flanders preaching the crusade. He said he had been appointed by Christ himself and had a letter from Christ proving it. I can't find any record of anybody who saw the letter, but he said he had it and he used to wave it over his head. Now, most of his followers thought he was the originator of the crusading idea, even though it was Urban II. It's often believed that Peter's army was a band of illiterate, incompetent peasants with no idea where they were going and who thought every major city they encountered was Jerusalem. But there'd been a long tradition of pilgrimage to Jerusalem that ensured that the location and distance of the city were well known to the majority. There were some well-trained minor knights leading him, such as Walter Sansevoire, also mistakenly known as Walter the Penniless. These were experienced soldiers. Now, in the late spring and summer of 1096, crusaders destroyed most of the Jewish communities along the Rhine in a series of unexpectedly large pogroms in France and Germany. Thousands of Jews were massacred, driven to suicide, forced to convert to Christianity. And the Pope saw an opportunity to get rid of what were basically problem children by sending them off to fight to free the Holy Land. Well, in 1097, crusaders led by Godfrey de Bouillon, Bohemian of Taranto, and Raymond IV, Count of Toulouse, began the siege of Antioch. 1209, Otto IV is crowned emperor of the Holy Roman Empire by Pope Innocent III. 1392, Japanese Emperor Go Kamayama abdicates in favor of the rival claimant Go Komatsu. 1512, Martin Luther joins the theological faculty at the University of Wittenberg. 1520, Ferdinand Magellan discovers a strait now known as the Strait of Magellan. 1520 also, João Álvares Fagundes discovers the islands of St. Pierre and Miquelon, bestowing them their original name, the Island of 11,000 Virgins. Of course, if you went there today, I don't think you could find more than a few. 1600, Tokugawa Ieyasu defeats the leaders of rival Japanese clans in the Battle of Sekigahara, becomes the Shogun of Japan, which, believe it or not, was an extremely powerful position. 1774, the flag of Totten, Massachusetts, is the first to include the word liberty. 1797, in Boston Harbor, a 44-gun U.S. Navy frigate, USS Constitution, is launched. 1805, Napoleonic Wars. A British fleet led by Lord Nelson defeats a combined French and Spanish fleet under Admiral Villanueva in the Battle of Trafalgar. 1824, Portland cement is patented. 1854, Florence Nightingale and a staff of 38 nurses are sent to the Crimean War. 1861, Union forces under Colonel Edward Baker defeated by Confederate troops in the second major battle of the war. 1867, the Medicine Lodge Treaty signed by the Southern Great Plains Indian leaders. Treaty requires Native American Plains tribes to relocate to a reservation in western Oklahoma. 1879, Thomas Edison applies for a patent for his design for an incandescent light bulb. ...1888, foundation of the Swiss Social Democratic Party. 1892, opening ceremonies for the World's Columbian Exposition are held in Chicago. But because construction was behind schedule, the exposition didn't open until May 1st, 1893. 1895, Republic of Formosa collapses as the Japanese forces invade. 1907... The 1907 Qaratagh earthquake hits the borders of Uzbekistan and Tajikistan, killing between 12,000 and 15,000 people. 1910, the HMS Niobe arrives in Halifax Harbor, becomes the first ship of the Royal Canadian Navy. 1921, President Harding delivers the first speech by a sitting president against lynching in the Deep South. 1931, a secret society in the Imperial Japanese Army launches an abortive coup d'etat attempt. 1940, the first edition of Ernest Hemingway's novel For Whom the Bell Tolls is published. In fact, I've got an autographed copy of that somewhere. 1943, the Provisional Government of Free India is formally established in Japanese-occupied Singapore. 1944, the first kamikaze attack damages HMAS Australia as the Battle of Leyte Gulf begins. Also in 44, the Nimmersdorf massacre against the German civilians takes place. 1944, the city of Aachen falls to American forces after 3 weeks of fighting, makes it the first German city to fall to the Allies. 1945, French women vote for the first time during the 1945 French legislative election. 1950, heavy fighting begins between British and and Australian forces against the North Koreans during the Battle of Yeongju. 1956, the Mau Mau Uprising in Kenya is defeated. 1959, New York City, the Solomon Guggenheim Museum opens to the public. Been there, it's a very interesting place. 1959, President Eisenhower approves the transfer of all U.S. Army space-related activities to NASA, including most of the Army Ballistic Missile Agency. 1965, the comet of Kyu-Seki approaches perihelion, passing 450,000 kilometers from the sun. 1966, a colliery spoil tip collapses on the village of Aberfan in Wales, killing 144 people, mostly school children. 1967, a national mobilization committee to end the war in Vietnam organizes a march of 50,000 people from the Lincoln Memorial to the Pentagon. And what's interesting, the leaders of all these different movements never served a day. Motion detected at the front door. 1969, the 69 Somali coup d'etat establishes a Marxist-Leninist administration. 1971, a gas explosion kills 22 people at a shopping center near Glasgow, Scotland. 1973, Fred Dreyer, the Los Angeles Rams, becomes the first player in NFL history to score two safeties in the same game. Now, Fred Dreyer went on to become an actor, a radio host, and a screenwriter. He starred in the series Hunter, which I thought was an interesting segue there. ''78, Australian civilian pilot Frederick Valentich vanishes over the Bass Strait south of Melbourne after reporting contact with an unidentified aircraft. It's believed he ran afoul of a UFO. 1979, Moshe Dayan resigns from the Israeli government because of strong disagreements with Prime Minister Menachem Begin over policy towards the Arabs. Moshe Dayan was the general with an eye patch. 1981, Andreas Papandreou becomes Prime Minister of Greece, ending an almost 50-year-long system of power dominated by conservatives. 1983, the meter is defined as the distance light travels in a vacuum in 1,299,792,458th of a second. In Lebanon, pro-Iranian kidnappers claim to have abducted American writer Edward Tracy. They released him in August of 91. 1987, the Jaffna hospital massacres carried out by Indian peacekeeping forces in Sri Lanka killed 70 ethnic Tamil patients, doctors, and nurses. 1994, North Korea and the U.S. signed an agreed framework that requires North Korea to stop its nuclear weapons program and agree to inspections. Also in 94, in Seoul, South Korea, 32 people are killed when the span of the Sangsu Bridge collapses. 2005, images of the dwarf planet Eris are taken and subsequently used in documenting its discovery. 2019, 30 people are killed in a fiery bus crash in Western Democratic Republic of Congo. And also in 2019, in Canada, the 2019 Canadian federal election ends, resulting in incumbent Prime Minister Justin Trudeau remaining in office, although in a minority government. I don't know how he can be the governor or the Prime Minister of Canada and keep doing his comic strip. That takes some doing. Okay. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Far too many to go into. Holidays, Apple Day in the United Kingdom, Armed Forces Day in Honduras, Christian Feast Day, Asterisk of Ostia, Berthold of Parma, Blessed Charles of Austria in the Roman Catholic Church, Fintan of Tagman, Hilarion, John of Bridlington, Laura of St. Catherine of Siena, Letitia, one of the Korean martyrs, Malchus of Syria, Peter Yi Te Chol, Severinus of Bordeaux, Tuda of Lindisfarne, Ursula, Viada of Lyons, Egyptian Naval Day in Egypt, Indian Police Commemoration Day in India, National Nurses Day in Thailand, Adade Day in Burundi, Overseas Chinese Day in Republic of China, Trafalgar Day in the British Empire in the 19th and early 20th century, and the birth of the Bab in the Bahia faith. And let's see if there's anything else of any interest. Saint Eusebius ended his reign as Catholic Pope in the year 310. 335, Roman Emperor Constantine the Great rules that Jews are not allowed to purchase and circumcise Christian slaves. 1096, well, we talked about the Peasants' Crusade. 1187, Alberto de Mora elected as Pope Gregorius VIII. That was in 1187. 1520, Ferdinand Magellan and his fleet reached Cape Virginis, becoming the first Europeans that we know of to sail into the Pacific Ocean. 1555, Emperor Charles V makes Erard of Palatinate Earl of Kuilemburg. 1639, a sea battle at Dunes. Lieutenant Admiral Martin Tromp defeats the Spanish Armada under de Oquendo. 1652, King Louis XIV returns to Paris. 1789, the French Revolution. The National Assembly declares martial law in France to prevent other uprisings, other than their own, of course. 1803, an English scientist named John Dalton reads his paper on the absorption of gases by water to the Manchester Literary and Philosophical Society. This was actually the first outline of his atomic theory, and that led to, eventually, Nagasaki and Hiroshima. Now, the Battle of Trafalgar that I talked about in 1805, British Admiral Horatio Nelson defeats the combined French and Spanish fleet, but a marksman shot and killed Nelson during the battle. 1816, the Penang Free School is founded in Georgetown in Penang, Malaysia, by the Reverend Hutchings. It's the oldest English language school in Southeast Asia. 1869, a momentous date. The first shipment of fresh oysters comes overland from Baltimore. 1878, German Chancellor Otto von Bismarck delegates end of socialism. 1914, the Battle of Warsaw ends with a German defeat. 1937, Francisco Franco's troops occupy Gijon. 1948, Beersheba is liberated by the Israeli army. 'Alrighty, I think we pretty much... By the way, the Guggenheim Museum that I talked about that opened in 1959 was actually designed by Frank Lloyd Wright, one of the best-known architects in modern America. Well, we've been talking about haunted El Paso, and there's a lot of other haunted places. On Oregon is what was the first Christian church building. It's across the street from the public library. Building about which numerous stories have been told. Originally built to house the first Christian church. It now sits forlorn and mostly empty. Now the first Christian church now occupies the entire 900 block on Arizona Street. But this wasn't always the case. In 1883, Philip Miner, who was a blacksmith, and his family moved to El Paso. By day, he worked at his forge, but in the evening, he was found praying and teaching the gospel to a few disciples he gathered together. In 1885, this little group that had grown to include 13 members became an organized congregation, even though it had nowhere to meet. But not letting a little thing like that stop them, the group showed they could be very resourceful in finding places which they could practice their religion. In this group were Millard Patterson, James Ashford, Zeno Clardy, William Caldwell, H.F. Sanders, Claude Miner, Emma Miner, Susie Brack, Ms. Robert Campbell, Ms. A.J. Stevens, Ms. Linda Moyer, Ms. E.C. Pugh, and the Reverend Miner. They first met in a small adobe house at 1st and Stanton Street and in a district courtroom, which was then located in a building on Campbell Street, also used by the post office, and then in a paint shop on Stanton Street. Finally, they got a building at 107 Myrtle Avenue. Unfortunately, its building was sold out from under him in 1903, but in January of 04, ground was broken for a brick building at the corner of Oregon and Franklin. And this building served as the church building till the new, larger church building was opened in 1952. Now, the building actually faces Oregon, but its length runs along Franklin. Now, since the First Christian Church moved to its new building, the new owners who bought the building divided it and rented it to a number of tenants. I talked to Daryl Height, who's director of the International Art Museum and who used to be partners with the owner of Barron's Primitive Indian Artifacts, who had his business in this building for a number of years. During slow periods, they had explored the building. And in the basement, they discovered a tunnel that runs underneath Franklin Street to the south. It's bricked up, but it's possible to see where the entrance to the tunnel was located. Mr. Hyatt said that in the basement, he would always feel strange if somebody was watching him. Strange sounds were heard and figures were seen. Now, the story about that tunnel is, if it wasn't bricked up, it would run all the way down to the river. And you could go into Mexico by going through a tunnel underneath the river. Certainly, that does raise some interesting questions. Then we have what used to be the Sheriff's Department building on Overland. Originally occupied by the Monson, Dunnigan, Ryan Company, and it's quite an old building. Been a large number of stories to come out of incidents that have happened at this location. Lupe Alvarez is the maintenance man at the building. He came in one morning at 6 and went to the second floor to get everything ready for the painting crew that was going to come in. As he's laying out the tarps, he heard voices nearby, and he searched the entire floor, but he couldn't find anybody else who could have been making the sounds he heard. And many times when he'd been on the fourth floor, he's heard footsteps following him down the hallways and heard voices. He's seen doors being shaken like somebody's trying to open them up. And each time he sees or hears something unusual, he's conducted a full search, but he's never found anything or anyone that could have made the sounds. Now, Martin Foreman was another individual who worked in the building who's had brushes with the unexplained. He's a World War II combat veteran who retired from the Detroit Police Department, and he currently serves as a coordinator of the volunteer unit at the Sheriff's Department. And he's usually the first one to arrive at the building each morning. normally getting to his fourth floor office at about 4 in the morning. On one particular morning, he arrived at his usual time, went into his office, and as was his custom, locked his office door behind him. A few minutes later, between 4 and 5 in the morning, all the lights went out, though from his windows he could see the lights were on at the nearby intersection of Paisano. Before he could react to losing the lights, his office door opened and a woman he didn't know walked in, stood in front of his desk, and just looked at him. Now, he said she wasn't somebody that worked in the building, so he asked her several times if there was something he could do to help her. She just stood there quietly staring down at him. And without a single word, she turned and left the room. Well, when the door closed behind her, Foreman jumped to his feet and tried to catch her, since she had no business wandering around in that building at that time of the morning. Opened his door and looked both ways down the long hallway, but she was nowhere to be seen. He eventually searched the entire floor, but couldn't find anybody else. He also noticed as he opened it that his door was still locked. How had she gotten in? Throughout the entire day, he mulled over what had happened that morning, but he couldn't find a logical reason for the occurrence. But he knew what he'd seen. Later, he told his co-worker, B. Hummel, what had happened that morning, expecting her to express her complete and total disbelief of his story. To his surprise, Ms. Hummel told Mr. Foreman that one of the cleaning ladies had told her that early one morning she'd entered the fourth floor and seen a couple dancing in the hallway. Cleaning lady told her that when she approached the dancers to ask who they were and what they were doing there, they vanished in front of her eyes. Herman Navarro, human resources director, related that she had been told by the cleaning ladies that they had several brushes with the spirits that haunt that building. Lucy Sanchez, a human resources clerk for the Sheriff's Department who works on the third floor, never believed the stories until 5 o'clock one Saturday morning when she and a friend had to work overtime. That Saturday, they heard somebody in the hallway outside the office in which they were working. When they had to investigate, they didn't ever find anything or anybody. That happened several times that morning till she and her friend began to ask others about the strange noises. They were told by members of the cleaning crew that they'd seen trash cans rise off the floor and the trash be thrown on the floor. In another instance, employees heard someone signal that they were trapped in the rear elevator. Custodian partially forced the doors open and they could hear somebody moving about in the elevator car, but when they managed to get the elevator car open, it was empty. Anthony Bedoya is a supervisor in the archives, but 7 years ago he was a lab technician. As he worked putting records on the microfilm, he saw a figure sitting in a nearby chair. Now, he said that figure was completely black. He couldn't see any features, just an outline of a black figure. He had heard that the previous supervisor used to stay late and she'd see shadows of a man moving about the floor and chairs had been moved across the floor. Now, the technician used to work in the archives and he made fun of him for seeing that black figure. One day he came running out of his work area, terrified after having seen a figure walk into a wall. Now, he made it clear he was a Christian and he didn't believe in ghosts. By his belief, once you're dead, you're dead. And the Bible says there are only angels or demons, so since the apparition wasn't an angel, he believed it had to be a demon. He also said that one of the previous directors had held seances and other ritual-type ceremonies in the work area, and he believes these activities may have stirred up something unknown that existed in the old building. Armando Sands is a senior clerk in the county archives section of the building. He's been employed by the county for 22 years in the county archives since 1991.
Motion detected at the front door.
In 1993, he was working late one evening, about 7:30 in the evening. He looked up and saw a lady dressed in a yellow dress out of the corner of his eye. When he looked, the director turned to where she'd been standing. There was nobody there. He worked overtime for the next 4 days, and each evening he'd see this tall, red-headed Caucasian lady in a yellow dress just standing quietly watching him. Thinking it might be his supervisor, who was red-headed and tall, he searched the area and found nothing. But he did say as he moved about the building, he felt like somebody was following him around. From that time forward, he said his life seemed to fall apart. He said everyone and everything seemed to be turning against him. When he'd be at work, he'd hear sounds and see things almost every day. And then one afternoon, after an especially trying day, he was leaving the building, dejected on the verge of quitting, he saw A transparent figure of a man with long hair wearing a robe similar to what's worn by a monk walked out of the wall by the third floor elevators. He said that figure came up and put an arm around his shoulder and said everything would be okay. Then that figure turned and walked back into the wall and vanished. He said from that point forward his life turned positive again. Now El Paso has some old buildings. One of which that I spent a lot of time wandering around was Southwest General Hospital. It began life in 1903 as the 19,000 square foot Albert Baldwin Health Resort Sanatorium for tuberculosis patients built by the former New Orleans postmaster David Baldwin, himself stricken with tuberculosis. The health resort began receiving suitable cases. Now, they did make clear no hopeless cases were accepted. But they accepted what they call suitable cases of tuberculosis on May 1, 1907. The first director was Dr. Charles Hendricks. 1910, the hospital was bought by Dr. R.B. Homan and renamed the Homan Sanatorium. 1924, Dr. Homan built a new hospital at the corner of Cotton and the Erie Streets, and the Homan Sanatorium fell into somewhat disuse. July 30, 1927, Sisters Ursula, Hildegard, Praxedes, Alexis, and Leonarda from the Order of Concordia at Concordia, Kansas, reopened the hospital of St. Joseph's. With the decrease in incidence of tuberculosis and need for general hospital beds in El Paso in 1936, Dr. Holman moved the tuberculosis patients at his second hospital located at Cotton and Erie to St. Joseph's.
Motion detected at the front door.
Remodeling and refurbishing the old facility. Remodeled 100-bed hospital began receiving patients on January 25, 1937, as the Southwest General Hospital. Now, Lady D, a local psychic, conducted an investigation into alleged spirits in this historic old building. She told me when she'd walked into one area, she is positive it had been a children's wing. Now, the hospital personnel with her denied the building had ever had a children's wing, but later it proved to be true. There had been a ward for children with tuberculosis in the hospital. When she'd walk into that wing, all the lights would go out and her sound man would lose contact with the station. Her seances were broadcast. When she walked back out of the wing, lights would come back on and connection with the station would be immediately reestablished. She sensed, and hospital staff later confirmed, that there's a nurse who was accidentally decapitated by elevator. And that nurse still works with hospital patients. She's seen periodically making her rounds. The spirit's been seen on a regular basis by both patients and staff. Now, what I found interesting was a number of reports that this mysterious nurse also dispenses medication. And while living nurses are occasionally in error about what they dispense, she is never in error. And one of the most unusual visions Lady D sensed on this trip was in a room up on the top floor. She was led to understand that this room was where a group of military test subjects had been isolated. She picked up that these soldiers were dying as a result of a betrayal surrounding their death. She felt that it was related to World War II, and it was an experiment that had gone horribly wrong because the spirits told her they had been lied to by their superiors about the experiment. They claimed they were being used as lab rats by the government. Well, she went to the basement and saw where the bodies of dead tuberculosis patients were burned. Spirits of the caretakers still lingered, reliving the burning of so many of the dead. They saw tunnels that appeared to run off into the distance. They weren't allowed to go into them, though. One man, a worker at the hospital, was killed under the elevator, and he's seen by the staff on a regular basis coming and going out of the elevator. He's such a common sight, the staff refers to him as Charlie. Well, according to one of the stories I heard, there was a workman working on one of the elevator cars, and the car had been put out of service, and he was underneath it. And as he was underneath it working, it went into operation, came all the way down and crushed him, and then went back up to the first floor. Is that Charlie? I don't know. Well, another hospital was referred to as Hotel Dew. 10 years after the arrival of the first railroads in El Paso in 1881, the town began to be known for its sunny, warm climate. Tent Town, a collection of small tents and shacks at the base of Mount Franklin, sprang up in 1891 to house people from all over who had come to find a cure for consumption, as it was called. We call it tuberculosis. That's when people realized they needed a hospital. Historian Cleophas Calero says there was a tremendous need for medical attention and the squalid sanitary conditions were an immense problem. Doctors from other towns aided the sick as much as possible in the tent city, but smallpox and tuberculosis were rampant. Well, a group of concerned citizens led by Edward Barron asked Reverend Charles Ferrari, pastor of St. Mary's Chapel, for help. The father spoke to Mother Mariana Flynn, visitrix of the Daughters of Charity of St. Vincent de Paul, about El Paso's need for professional medical assistance. Four nuns from Detroit arrived here the first week of February 1892 to open St. Mary's Hospital of the Sisters of Charity. It became known as the Sisters Hospital. Their purpose was to administer to the sick and afflicted of all nationalities and all faiths. Sister Mary Stella Dempsey, Dolores Sophia Eggert, Genevieve Alice Hennessy, and Mary Lee started the first hospital in a small two-story house at 1015 East Overland, rented by Father Ferrari. Now, the patient load grew rapidly, and the hospital quickly outgrew its three rented rooms. March of 1892, the nuns moved their hospital to the Dieter Home at 415 Upson, which were operated from May 1892 to January 25, 1894. But this location also proved to be too small to handle El Paso's needs for medical treatment. With the help of El Paso women, the sisters began a huge fundraising campaign, eventually borrowing the money from a local bank and the mother house to purchase an entire block of land between Arizona and Montana streets. On January 25, 1894, Hotel Dew, as the sisters named it, moved to its new location at the corner of Stanton and Rio Grande streets. This new hospital, which was considered luxurious in comparison to its previous site, was remodeled and named after the famous hospital building, Hotel Dieu in Paris, where the first Daughters of Charity cared for the sick and the indigent. Costing $75,000, the hospital had 80 rooms with a chapel on the second floor. The business office, the nursing lecture room, and the pharmacy occupied the rest of the second floor. The third floor provided private rooms for surgical patients, and the fourth floor was devoted to obstetrics. The fifth floor, like the basement, had operating rooms. According to Caleros, there was no electricity, so gas was used for lighting and wood is used for fuel and heating. 2 years later, 1904, the north wing was completed and dedicated. Hotel Dew and the nuns received as a gift their first ambulance, a buggy drawn by two black horses, a donation that was valued at $1,200. When the Sisters of Charity arrived in El Paso, they had in mind to start a nursing program to be able to staff their hospital. So in 1898, they opened a training school for nurses on North Kansas and Arizona streets, the first nursing school in El Paso. That the hospital was next to the school is important because nursing students could train with actual patients. 1902, the first graduating class consisted of four students: Bessie Parker of Nova Scotia, Rose Warden of El Paso, Bessie Driscoll of Chicago, and Sarah Moores of Philadelphia. These registered nurses then began working at Hotel Dew Hospital. During World War I, many students used their skills in aiding the wounded that were brought into El Paso. The school then moved to the old Moorhead School at the corner of Arizona and Campbell in 1927 and had a student body of about 65 students. As the school improved and more students applied for admission to the three-year program, the sisters moved to another location in the 1960s. With a grant of $100,000 from the Moody Foundation, the then-new nursing school, housing 200 students, opened on Kansas Street across from the old school. The nursing school is now part of the University of Texas at El Paso College of Nursing and Allied Health. Hotel Dew itself continued to grow in the 20th century, and once more, in 1946, the Sisters of Charity began raising funds to build a new hospital. In April 1950, groundbreaking ceremonies took place for building a 270-bed facility. When the south wing was completed, the original building was razed to make room for the center wing. In April 1953, the new Hotel Dew opened to serve patients. In the early 70s, a third north wing was added. Well, as Hotel Dew grew, so did its medical specialties and technology. The hospital offered telemetry, coronary, and intensive care units. It specialized in renal disease treatment and boasted a respiratory care center. It's also well known for its obstetrics department. Hotel Dew served El Paso and surrounding communities for almost 100 years until El Paso found itself with 800 too many hospital beds, and the sisters sold the medical center on December 5, 1987. The building stood for a long time at the corner of Stanton and Rio Grande Streets and was rented out to various tenants for office space. Small medical practices have come and gone, and the empty building, which was named a landmark and owned by the county, was searching for a new owner. Sister Paula Ansel, former director of nursing at Hotel Dew, told El Paso Times columnist Mary Margaret Davis, "When we sold the hospital, we promised the people we'd remain in El Paso." Seven of the sisters work at St. Vincent Family Health Center, opened by the order in 1988. Center helps less fortunate that have no insurance or money to pay for medical needs. They also distribute food and clothing to the poor at the Ladies of Charity Center on Campbell. Sisters practice the same philosophy that brought them to the Sun City over 100 years ago. It's reflected in their motto, "The Charity of Christ Urges Us." As might be expected, many of the spirits at Rome Hotel Dew stem from its days as a hospital. There's one figure that's been seen many times dressed in garb from the late 1800s wearing a stovepipe hat. He was found to be a doctor from New Mexico who had placed a lot of patients at Hotel Dew. As he spent a great deal of his time making rounds checking on his patients in life, he now continues to be seen making the rounds of patient rooms, and his presence is especially strong in the operating rooms. And the spirits of some of the nuns who dedicated themselves to caring for others continue to move about the building on errands that they carried out during life. Well, now that the old structure is being torn down, where will they go? Do they stay? Do they go to whatever is built there? It's a vacant lot when last I was down in that area. And then there's a building I'm somewhat familiar with, the Mesa Hill Specialty Hospital in North Oregon. Building that was occupied by Mesa Hill Specialty Hospital was originally built as a hotel for those attending UTEP. But the business failed, and the business was used as a center for several small businesses, one of which was a children's halfway house for children who were ill or who had been abused. And later it was purchased and used for a nursing home. Connie Wang, a psychic and also a nurse, worked at the nursing home facility located in the building at one time. She said she first learned about one of the ghosts when some of the elderly male patients in the nursing home would complain about the little girl that would wander their rooms at night wanting to talk to them. Now, of course, there were no children to wear it on the floors except during visiting hours, but some of the patients would complain about hearing children laughing and talking. She found that she could feel the different entities as she moved about the building doing her duties. On the third floor near the dining area, there are several entities who like to live there, watching the activity of the patients and just walking to and fro. At the end of the hall on the third floor, there are four gentlemen who stand in the corner at the end of the hall and just watch the activity that goes on around them. Now, none of them appear to mean any harm. They just want to be part of what goes on around them. She also said there's a nurse that walks the hallway, and that sometimes this spectral nurse makes the rounds just ahead of the real nurse on duty and actually gives out the medication. On more than one occasion, when the nurse on duty has gone into a room to give the patient the prescribed medication, the patient maintains the nurse just gave the medication to him. Interestingly enough, the phantom nurse always gives the correct medication. Well, turning from medical spirits, we have public spirits. You know, Paso, a large number of buildings that were or are open to public have stories of ghosts and unusual happenings and unexplained deaths associated with them. There's the La Hacienda restaurant on Paisano. You know, this location was the scene of much history in this area, and there have been many stories about this building and area around it. The restaurant known as La Hacienda sits on the banks of the Rio Grande and separates the city of El Paso, Texas, from Ciudad Juarez, Mexico. The building that houses this well-known eating establishment has a long history and has been the site of a number of events that have been of historical note. On May 4, 1598, Don Juan Oñate crossed the Rio Grande from what's now Mexico into what's Texas on his journey north. Local legend has long said he crossed the Rio Grande at the location where Hacienda now sits. There's a small park between La Hacienda and the river commemorating this event. A young man by the name of Simeon Hart, who'd been born in Highland, New York in 1816, came through El Paso in 1847 as part of General Sterling Price's command on the way to join American forces already fighting in the Mexican War. Hart was wounded in the Battle of Santa Cruz de los Rosales in Chihuahua and was carried for it to home of Don Leonardo Siqueiros, whose prosperous flour mill is known far and wide as El Molino. As Simeon Hart recuperated, he and his nurse, Don Siqueiros' lovely daughter Jesucita, fell in love. The two were married, and rather than return to New York, he brought his bride to El Paso, where work was begun on a flour mill and a beautiful mansion in 1849 that wasn't completed until 1854. The flour mill came to be known as El Molino, just like the one in Mexico. The home was originally plastered adobe with high ceilings, a flat roof with a parapet. Adjacent to the house, he built a flour mill very much like that of his father-in-law. And the house at Hart's Mill became known as a haven of hospitality for travelers, whether they went north or south. Simeon Hart and James McGoffin were El Paso's chief supporters of the Confederacy. And as a result, when the South lost the war and Reconstruction began, Hart lost his property, though he readily regained much of it. Eventually, his son, Juan Hart, who founded the El Paso Times, settled in, making the house the social hotspot in El Paso. After the Confederate defeat in Glorieta Pass, the California Column came into El Paso in 1862 and established their headquarters in the same area. In 1881, Fort Bliss moved from its previous location to a site very close to Hart's Mill, later moved to its permanent home on the other side of El Paso on the Mesa. Some of the quarters that were built to house the officers of the garrison still stand very near to La Hacienda. But that's another story. I've heard many stories that during the height of his power, Pancho Villa would cross the border and visit the Hart's Mill location. Seems that he, too, was captivated by the warmth and charm of the home that's become such a well-known eating establishment. During the height of combat that took place in war, several of the eastern newspapers used Hart's Mill's home as their base of operations when we're here covering Villa's raids into Juarez. A great deal of Mexican history was written about as it was made only a few hundred yards to the south. After almost 100 years as a private residence, a stagecoach stop, and some say a brothel, and once again a home, the Hacienda's had that had belonged to Simeon Hart that he'd loved so much became home to La Hacienda, a much beloved restaurant. It first opened as a public restaurant in 1940. The open layouts, and typically the early Hacienda design, lent itself readily to the new use. The broad, shaded porches where passengers had so eagerly awaited for the stagecoaches were enclosed for additional seating. The warm, inviting atmosphere of La Hacienda's ensured the eatery was quick to become a favorite meeting spot of El Paso politicians, locals, and tourists alike. Along with the politicians, locals, and tourists, it appears that La Hacienda has become a favorite haunt for a number of ghosts that have allegedly been seen in and around the restaurant. Some have said that Pancho Villa himself returned to this spot, which he seemed to love so much. Several people have said they've seen him on the patio and in the Pancho Villa bar, where hangs a copy of his death mask. Other stories have said that Don Yanyo Nate has been seen in the outdoor patio area. Another person told me the spirit of a young man has been frequently seen by staff and customers alike. He seems to like sitting quietly, enjoying the company. Then there's the spirit of a young, attractive woman who's been seen sitting on a bar stool in one of the bars. Said to be smoking a cigarette and laughs at people who see her. Several told me her name is Felina. Maybe Marty Robbins heard the name of the cantina wrong and it was La Hacienda, not Roses, where Felina was seen dancing. Then there are the many stories about members of the staff seeing plates and silverware have been placed on the tables move with no one nearby, and some have even flown off the table onto the floor. Footsteps have clearly been heard when there's no one there who could possibly have made those footsteps. Disembodied voices called the names of various staff members, and cold spots are felt, and doors open and close with no one nearby. In addition to the spirits said to haunt the La Hacienda inside its walls, there is a number of stories and legends about the general area occupied by Hart's Mill and the La Hacienda restaurant. It has also seen its share of ghosts and spirits. One of the most famous of these stories is about the birds at Hart's Mill. Though to me, this particular story seems to be a version of La Llorona's story. According to Dr. Shonison, many years ago, a Mexican woman was living in Paso del Norte. She was a widow with two children and wanted so much to marry so she wouldn't have such a hard life. She met a man and offered her the comfort she desired, but he didn't want to take responsibility for her two children. He wanted her to send them to live with her relatives, but she'd always refused to be parted from her beloved children. Finally, he gave her an ultimatum, him or the children. She had to make a choice from which there was no going back. She chose the man, and according to the story, she drowned both her children near the dam at Hart's Mill. There's a monument that marks the site of this mill just off the highway leading north out of El Paso. The mill structure itself has long since gone away, given way to time and the elements and progress. It's no more. But many remember the location where it stood and gave long years of service to the community. When the woman told the man what she had done, he was horrified and wanted nothing more to do with her. According to the story, she still haunts the spot in the form of a bird with a plaintive voice. She can be heard at twilight calling for her lost children. Says until she finds them, she can never be restored to human form or ever find peace in the grave. Some evening at twilight, go park in the parking lot of La Hacienda and listen carefully. Is what you hear the wind or a heartbroken mother calling for her lost children? Now, the next two stories deal with the legend of La Llorona. There's an interesting story called The Bloody Box of El Paso. I can't vouch for the truth of these stories, but they are interesting, so for that reason I'm presenting them. According to the story and the individual telling it, when they were a young child growing up in El Paso, a dusty desert city right up along the Mexican border, there were many different and fascinating legends, ghost stories, and superstitions to be heard. The area is very old and rich with folklore and a very bloody history that lends itself to all kinds of interesting tales. One particular story, the story of La Llorona, really translates as the crier, which is exactly what this spook is said to eternally do. Part sorrowful banshee, part angry spirit, part cursed creature, La Llorona is known almost to every Latin culture. In fact, the first story dates back to 1550. And there does seem to be different versions according to the region, but the stories are all centered on a woman who murdered her two small children hundreds of years ago. The teller of this story was told that long ago there was a widow with two small children who lived in the poorest section of Juarez, Mexico. Somehow she met a man who was rather wealthy and began a relationship with him. She was tired of being poor and having to struggle and wanted to marry the man, live a life of luxury, at least compared to what she was living. Problem was the man didn't want to marry her because she had children, so she took her two young children down to the Rio Grande. In the dead of night, she stabbed them and threw them into the river where they drowned. And then, still wearing the bloody nightgown, she slipped through the night to her lover's house to show him the extent of that she'd gone to in order to be with him.
Motion detected at the garage door.
When the man saw her at his doorstep in the blood-streaked white gown, far from impressed, he was horrified. He rejected her, which drove her mad as she realized what an evil thing she had done, all for nothing. She ran back to the river, screaming and tearing at her hair, trying in vain to find her children, but it was too late. Now, at this point, the story varies, as some people say she drowned herself in the same river she used earlier to snuff out her children's lives. Others insist she was caught by an angry mob, killed for her crimes, and then thrown in the river. Either way, the result's the same. She died. And that's where the creepiness begins. Not long after her death, people who lived along the river started to report hearing this horrible wailing, banshee-like crying coming from the riverbanks in the dead of night. And then the sightings began. People started to relate tales of seeing a horrible apparition wandering the riverbanks at night. Something with the body of a woman but the head of a horse. The creature is said to be wearing a long, white, bloody nightgown.
Motion detected at the garage door.
As it glides up and down the river, searching the water and wailing horribly. people of the community said it was the spirit of the woman, cursed to wander the banks of the Rio Grande for all eternity. Now, locals are warned against going near the river alone at night and are told if she found you there, she'd take you to the place of one of her children to keep her company in her vigil by the river. Now, the apparition was given a name, La Llorona, because of her eerie wailing sobs and wails. And to this day, when somebody's found drowned in the Rio Grande,
motion detected at the front door,
which happens constantly, people whisper La Llorona is still lonely and looking for company. Well, another story. When the person that told this one was a teenager, they used to pile in a car and drive down to the river at night, daring each other to get out and walk the banks looking for La Llorona. And there were actually quite a few times when they heard the hair-raising, blood-curdling sobbing that almost sounded like some weird garbled babbling coming from the banks of the river. But they did have a very freaky, mysterious experience out there one night. One time when they were down there, they drove over a bridge and went across the river to the other, darker, scarier side. They all got out and looked around a little bit, walking down the banks, and one friend went the other way alone, back toward the bridge, and all of a sudden they heard him yell like he was being startled. When they looked down where he was, they saw him hurl something toward the bridge and come running back to the car. He yelled at him to get in and go. Well, without bothering to look, they jumped in the car and he said he saw a horrible monster woman standing in the middle of the bridge looking at him. He said he was so scared he threw his pocket knife at it. They were all totally thinking he was trying to scare him, so they were laughing and weren't taking him seriously. They headed back over the bridge to the other side, which was the only exit out of where they were at. They found their way blocked by a box sitting in the very center of that narrow bridge. And there was no way it was there before. They wouldn't have gotten over the bridge the first time. So needless to say, they were all scared witless, and there was a big debate about who would get out and move the thing, and of course nobody wanted to be the one to do it, and there was no other way out unless they did move it. So they decided half would get out and move it together, and went over, they could see a dark liquidy stuff dripping down the sides, and they lifted the lid, and they freaked out. The box was filled with blood, bloody organs, pieces of bone, hair, and other unidentifiable stuff. One of the kids shoved the box to the edge of the bridge so they could get by, and the rest ran back to the car. They tore out of there as fast as they could and pulled over to the first place they found, an old bar, and ran in asking to use the phone. They called the police who came out and met them at the bar. Then they asked us to lead them back where they had seen the box, and they did, and to their surprise, it was still there. They expected it to be gone. Police got out and checked it out, and as soon as they opened the box and shone their flashlights inside, they both unholstered their guns. One called for backup, and the other shined his light in the bushes along the riverbank, had his gun in his other hand. Meanwhile, all the kids were sitting in the car, totally freaked out over it, and no cop cars got there. More cops came, took statements, and they had to leave. The only explanation anybody ever gave them was maybe it was bait from a fisherman who left it by the river after fishing. Well, if it wasn't for the fact there were several other people there, and there were police statements to prove it, you'd think such a story was made up. Well, one of the young man who threw the pocket knife insists he saw La Llorona, and he's convinced she left the box for him. Some of the others think they stumbled across a murderer who was dumping what was left of his victim. Another friend even had a theory somebody satanic and evil is leaving an offering for La Llorona. The question is, what do you believe? Well, we've come to the end of another show. We'll be back tomorrow night when I'll finish telling you about La Llorona. Until then, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening. Door.